Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer of the show. Pharma Talk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to those in life sciences, and in particular, drug development. And this, of course, always includes patients and patient advocacy. Today's program is focused around a particular approach to helping transform clinical research. It's about Pfizer's Blue Sky approach. I'm so pleased to welcome for the first time to Pharma Talk Radio my co-host and colleague Ed Misetta. Ed is the chief editor of clinicalleader.com, and he also contributes to Life Science Leader as a writer. And Ed and I are joined by three members of the Blue Sky team, where we will talk about the vision, goals, and journey in taking this new approach to help advance drug development. Ed, before we introduce our guests, can you tell our listeners about the information you cover and bring to people through clinicalleader.com?
Absolutely. Clinicalleader.com is a website where we basically try to focus on the business side of clinical trials. So you won't see a lot of discussions about specific medicines and conditions, but more looking at the hot topics, the trends that are really affecting executives in the clinical space, and basically sharing stories from their peers at other companies about how they're overcoming those challenges and making new technologies and innovations really work for them. So I'm thrilled to be with you today. I'm looking forward to DPharm next month and learning more about those innovations, and certainly this discussion today on Blue Sky, which I think will have a lot of interest for all of our readers.
Thanks, Ed. Ed, so with that, I would like to welcome our three guests from Pfizer. We have Dr. Stephen Amato, who is a project manager at Blue Sky, and David Couette, who is the senior director, strategy and operations lead at Blue Sky and quantitative medicine. And we have Dr. Daniel Carlin, who is the senior director, quantitative medicine, clinical lead at Blue Sky. And both Dan and David will be presenting at the DPharm conference on September 20th. And Dan is also the chair of the Mobile and Clinical Trials Conference, which takes place the day before on September 19th. And I want to welcome everyone to the program. And so to begin, can you tell us about how the Blue Sky concept came to be at Pfizer? I'll open it up as a question to all three of you.
Okay, it's David, and I'll take that one. So late last year, there was a discussion with some of the senior leaders in the neuroscience and pain research unit about how we can bring kind of the way we conduct clinical studies to quote unquote the 21st century, and some of the questions that came to the forefront were how can we ensure objective measurement of patient symptoms and continuous measurement of patient symptoms. So that was kind of a brainstorming session, and under the leadership of Peter Bergeton, who's now the Chief Scientific Officer of Neuroscience and Pain Research Unit, this took form, and we started talking about it more and thinking about how we could do that, if it was something that Pfizer could do in-house, or if we could partner up with somebody to do that. And this idea actually came to fruition in late December when we signed, a collaboration with a big IT and consulting company, IBM, and things went really quickly from that point on, where we've built a team, a Blue Sky team, composed of members from IBM and Pfizer, and we're moving quickly into trying to implement the vision of having more objective digital continuous measurement of symptoms, so we can better understand patient disease status.
And I think it's important that folks recognize, this is Dan, that this all comes in the context of changing pressures in pharma development largely, but particularly it seems in neuroscience, where it's been really hard to get phase three wins with novel mechanisms. So the pressure that is put on the early clinical development around these compounds is to devise ways of knowing in our early trials, what would traditionally be safety studies even, we need to find ways of knowing whether we have confidence that the medicine will do what it ought to do, and I use auto kind of loosely, but do what we would hope it would do mechanistically or what we have evidence it does in animals in people. So to that end, we have this interesting dovetail of the evolution of consumer and clinical technology with more and more availability of tiny microprocessors, and almost everything runs some version of Linux on it now, even really small wearable devices and Internet of Things devices. So we've got this evolution of sensing technology happening on the one hand, and the changing world of drug discovery in neuroscience, where we need ways of seeing smaller changes sooner in a more continuous way. So it's actually a perfect environment for us to reach out and say, how do we integrate these? How do we use high temporal and spatial granularity measures that are just now becoming commoditized and ubiquitous to support the early clinical development process? Alongside of that, there's the thought that eventually these new measures will supplement, if not replace, traditional endpoints when we bring forward compounds to regulators. So while we're initially developing measures that ought to support early clinical development and build our rationale for internal decision-making and guiding future studies of a compound, the hope is that as we develop these measures alongside the compounds, we actually build a rationale for bringing forward the endpoints derived from the new measures toward registration. And so we see this across every pharma company working in these spaces, that the hope is that in a collaborative nature, really, not that we can sit here and say, okay, here's the new Pfizer Parkinson's endpoint. Yeah, nobody believes that's a viable thing, and nobody should. But the idea being that we can, working together through the development of data standards and standardized means of measuring these high granularity changes, cooperatively develop internal rationale, which eventually becomes essentially external rationale and is accepted by regulators and ultimately payers as evidence of the drug's effectiveness.
All right, thank you. Ed, I'll let you take over. I know you have a couple of questions that you've been wanting to ask the team.
Great. Thank you, Valerie. I guess my first question is, how did Pfizer come about identifying IBM as the best partner to use on this study?
So we've certainly talked to a lot of folks in this process and a lot of potential partners along the way. As I get into this answer, it's also worth pointing out that the nexus, the center of mass for this project exists in this space between IBM and Pfizer, but by no means are we trying to do this on our own, just the two of us. So while we are the primary partners in this, there are a number of other partners in the technology and Parkinson's space who we're working with as well. Ultimately, though, IBM was chosen as the primary partner for this and the true collaborator for a number of reasons. We have many relationships with IBM already, so there are a lot of internal projects and ongoing work streams where IBM is tightly integrated. Of course, a project like Blue Sky, with its cross-company really implications, has to integrate with other data projects. So our existing relationships with IBM were very favorable, and our experience in interacting with them around the project suggested that they had both the appetite, interest, and ability to be a good partner in this space, so that they supplement and complement us in a way that perhaps another company wouldn't, in that we have certain areas of expertise running clinical trials and understanding what we need to measure, and certainly the clinical expertise internally, and even on our team we have a number of neurologists and me as psychiatrists. I don't suppose that's super useful, but certainly for team dynamics maybe. But the ability to really round that out with a technical, mathematical, and computational skill set that IBM brings robustly to the table, and reaching into the IBM organization, which is vast and diverse, gives us the ability to access all sorts of supporting and enabling technologies that progress this project.
Great. And I think anybody who's involved in this space has seen the figures about the cost of conducting a trial and how many years it takes to complete a trial. These sensors are obviously going to deliver a lot more data than maybe sponsors have been used to getting in the past. Can you talk briefly about how access to that type of data will help us to speed up trials for new drugs?
Yeah, the data is really where the money is here. That's the interest, right? So the rest of it is enabling. The rest of it is methods, but the goal is the data. The goal are the data. Regardless, the ability for us to internalize, to digest vast quantities of high-resolution data isn't unique to this IBM collaboration, to Blue Sky. We're really thinking about this across the company and across our trial space. Historically, Pfizer and other pharma companies have externalized the processing of even lower-resolution instruments down to endpoints and then internalized the scalar values of the endpoints, because that was what we needed. That was what our decision-making was based on. That was what we could use. That was what we could submit. And truth be told, it's what we could understand. In our current environment, almost every instrument is being seen as generating what one might call raw data, though we try to stay away from that term because it can be used a little loosely. But the instrument-derived data from instruments across our research space is now striving to be internalized. So we want to bring these things in at their most dense, highest granularity, highest resolution form. And even if we don't know exactly what to do with those data when we get them, even if all we're going to do is go down a traditional path and convert them into the scalar endpoint values, what we've recognized now is that when we look back into our trial data, we all wish we had a lot more of those higher resolution, higher dimensional data. So we're building systems internally, both specifically for Blue Sky and across our research space, that allow us to internalize, work with, process high-resolution data. And that includes being able to process things on multiple pathways, right? So the idea that you can analyze data in a number of different ways. Once you own these data, you can non-destructively process them. So you keep the mass copy, you keep the big copy, and run it down a bunch of different processing pathways to try to see what's there. And as we evolve new ways of combining different sets of data, as we move toward more machine learning-oriented ways of thinking about large data sets, the goal moving forward is that no one in 10 years looks back at our research now and goes, oh, I wish they'd kept the data, which is what we end up saying all too often now.
That's very interesting, and you make a very good point there about the importance of the data. And when I talk to companies who are venturing into this space, it seems like one of the biggest decisions that they have to make is deciding on what types of sensors or monitoring devices that they're going to use in a trial. Can you touch a little bit on how it is that Pfizer came about deciding on what sensors that they would use here?
Yeah, so this is Steve here. I'll be happy to field that question. I think what's important to note here is something that actually Dan had brought up in one of the early conversations we had as the project was unfolding and we were deciding on our plan of attack, and that was to separate device versus sensor. So kind of the definition here being a sensor that's an instrument that detects events or environmental changes and provides an output, whereas a device is a collection of those sensors. And really what our goal is at this point is to identify the sensor and data requirements that are necessary in order to produce the data that we can then process and transform and pull out meaningful endpoints that will accurately report on the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And due to accelerated timelines, we thought the best way to approach this problem was to use essentially devices that already contain a number of these sensors as we go about and define those requirements. And again, as Dan pointed out earlier, this is a constantly very dynamic process where as we develop the actual requirements for the sensors, we can then take that information and make informed decisions about what devices to use going forward in our subsequent studies.
When we think robustly about the data, this is Dan again, it becomes evident that there are ways to parameterize and internalize data that make us much less sensor dependent. So in a sense, we can begin to understand our data in a sensor agnostic way. So while we know what sensor derives the data and we know the device in which that sensor lived and maybe the on-chip or onboard processing the data went through on their way to our storage repositories, our goal is to minimize the variance that's generated by on device processing, right, that ultimately can be a proprietary black box, and to really understand our signals in terms of what they represent about the biological activity that underlies them, so that in a sense, devices which contain, as Steve mentioned, a collection of sensors, right, and most of those sensors may be fundamentally the same, but then devices have a form factor, they have a way of being worn, they have a battery and therefore a battery life, they have a method of transferring data from the sensors, maybe storing it first and then transferring it. So there's a lot of other steps built into the device level of this kind of experimentation. And ultimately, in the Blue Sky project, there's going to be a point where we'll have a collection of devices, each containing a collection of sensors, and we're able to make decisions around which device to use in a trial based on parameterization issues, based on things like battery life and data transfer, and understand those signals interchangeably with a study where we've had to make different device decisions based on those other more operational characteristics of the devices. So again, by going back to the data, at its most foundational level, the hope is that we don't think about this in terms of sort of brand name devices. So at some level, you got to buy devices and you have to send them and you have to service them and have contracts to operate them. But at the level of understanding the biology, that should be separate. And so at Pfizer particularly, where there was a history of buying a device and being somewhat locked into that manufacturer's processing and their output and their endpoints, we don't think you can do that anymore. We can't have data that are only meaningful in the context of a vendor relationship. We need to have data that remain meaningful and that are translatable from device to device, if not totally able to be equivocated between them.
And one more thing is that the form factor of the devices, and depending where we need these devices to be worn on the subjects to capture, you know, the appropriate data that we want, will also play a role into which, you know, devices we choose for what purpose. So some of them can be, you know, on a little strap that you can put around your chest or on a wrist or an ankle. Some of them are, you know, kind of sticky. So there's different ways to look at devices depending on where we actually want to place them on the subject to collect the appropriate information.
That's interesting, and it makes me think of two additional questions here, and maybe we can take these one at a time, but I'm thinking about now the facility and the patients. Can you touch on how difficult it was for Pfizer to set up this research facility and maybe how big a help your partner IBM was in that effort?
Sure. So first of all, IBM has been really committed from the beginning. And so to tell you a little bit of a story about this, one of the first times we went over to Yorktown Heights in New York to meet with IBM folks, we were thinking about how to just to set up that research facility and what we could do. And they said, oh, we have this old house over here on site that's from the 1860 or something. And that's kind of just being used for storage. So maybe we could request access to this house and, you know, kind of like refurbish it or rehabilitate it into a laboratory where we can, you know, run studies for Blue Sky. So we took a tour of the house and we quickly, you know, brainstormed how we could best set this up. And IBM really took the lead on this, where they you know, requested from their site lead, you know, access to this house, and then were granted it and immediately started the remodeling process. And they really took ownership of that piece, and in partnership with us, you know, we are designing this to be kind of an instrumented house where we can bring patients in. And although, you know, there will be cameras and microphones in many places, it really feels warm and like a house, and you really feel comfortable performing, you know, activities and daily living in that house. And we'll be able to capture a lot of important data from patients in that setting. So IBM was instrumental in getting that done. They took the lead on this. And this house will be the, like I said, the setting for some of our studies to test the, you know, the devices that Dan and Steve mentioned before. So they were extremely helpful, and we're looking forward to this in the next few months, you know, starting to bring folks in the house and, you know, instrument them with our devices, and then, you know, provide them with a list of daily activities that we would like them to perform in no particular order, whenever they feel like it. And it could be, you know, turn a doorknob or pour yourself a glass of water or do things like that, to climb up a flight of stairs. And with the sensors on, with the cameras capturing their, you know, behaviors, we'll be able to really have gather a wealth of data from these subjects in our house. Don't know if Dan or Steve, you want to add anything else to that?
Ultimately, to me, this represents an attempt, which is happening similar to other attempts, to bring early clinical development researchers closer to the patient and the subjects and their lived experience and their experience with devices and their ideas about methods. So there are other things happening in this project as well, where we're reaching out to Parkinson's patients in this phase. We haven't even really officially strapped any devices onto anybody, and we're talking to folks about measurements that they think have relevance to their experience of the disease, to their well-being. Being closer to research subjects is something that's really tough in clinical trials for a number of regulatory reasons and to maintain the integrity of the clinical trial. In these method development studies, in these clinical research collaborations, the ability for our researchers to be closer makes a huge difference, because there are sort of infinite observations that can be made at that point in the study, right there with the patient, with the subject, with the devices, with the data, that can inform the evolution of the method. So where we're able to be closer to the subject, where we're able to make sure the subject's experience of the method, the experience of the measure, the corroboration between what they're feeling and what our measures say, where we can do that, we have to. And it's clear that that's the direction things have to move.
And you made another wonderful point there. I think in that last question I referred to this as a research facility, but you correctly pointed out that this is really an instrumented house that folks are going to be living in, comfortable as any house we can envision. But we all still understand the struggle of patient recruitment. It's rare that I talk to somebody in the pharma industry who doesn't have concerns about recruitment. And for this study to work, you still had to find patients, find and recruit patients who are willing to spend time within this instrumented house. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy that your team used to recruit patients for that?
We can certainly talk about our anticipated strategy. We have not yet brought folks with Parkinson's disease in, and that's for a really important reason, and I think that it's worth me pointing this out now. There is nothing more valuable to us than subjects' time, comfort, and data. And so for us, all of the technical hurdles, all of our understanding of the data, all of our knowledge about what maneuvers in the UPDRS and activities of daily living generate good data versus don't, all of that work we're doing with volunteers, mostly employee volunteers, quite frankly, of the two companies. And with minimal advertising into the companies, you know, we put IRB-approved flyers out, essentially, and easily got enough volunteers to populate our entire healthy volunteer study, times a couple orders of magnitude, really. You know, our phones were ringing off the hook. People are eager to help inside the company. And so as much as we can do to minimize wasted subject time, effort, data, we're going to do. And then when it comes time to bring folks with Parkinson's in, we're working with treaters in these cities nearest to where we're working, so with folks in neurology who treat Parkinson's patients. Unlike perhaps a clinical trial where recruitment can be particularly hard because of very specific inclusion-exclusion criteria related to safety of an experimental compound, in this case, because we don't have to be so strict about inclusion and exclusion, and we can give folks with more complex disease, with comorbidities, with abnormal labs that might preclude them from a clinical drug study, we can bring folks in who want to help. And what we ultimately find is, just like the healthy volunteers, when we recruit patient populations, which we've done in other domains in our work in methodology development, that when patients who maybe can't participate in clinical drug trials get the opportunity to come help build a data set that can ultimately be useful in the diagnosis, treatment, and pharma development for Parkinson's disease, everyone who can do it wants to do it. We very rarely in this space have the sort of troubles with recruitment that you'd expect based on what's experienced more largely in the clinical trials environment.
It's really wonderful to hear that. You know, there's a huge focus nowadays on patient centricity, and I hope to at some point in the future go to one of Valerie's Patients as Partners conferences and maybe even hear more about how this worked out and what you were able to do for patients. I guess I'm going to ask one final question, and I'll go ahead and turn it back over to Valerie. But we all know that in the past, oftentimes when a patient goes to see their physician, that physician is basically looking at a snapshot of that person's health. I think one of the biggest promises of mHealth and mobile devices is the fact that we're now going to have this continuous flow of data over a period of time that those physicians will be able to look at. Can you tell me how significant a change that will be for the doctors who are treating these patients?
A very significant change. So this is of great interest across clinical medicine, well beyond development, of course, and you know, here you're talking about doctors treating patients, which of course is not what we do, right? We develop drugs that help doctors treat patients, but what we see in this work is the opportunity to advance both drug development and research alongside with advancing clinical care. It's particularly important in the sorts of diseases like Parkinson's disease, where there's a daily fluctuating course, and a weekly fluctuating course, and a monthly, and a progression over the course of years, right? This is something that if you show up for the conferences that we talked about earlier, it's certainly something that I talk about every chance I get. When you have random measurement of fluctuating data and try to predict an overarching course from that, you can be very much wrong. You have just a random sample bias, and you don't know which way you're wrong. You don't know why you're wrong, really, except that you happen to measure the thing when you happen to measure it in the course of its day-to-day or week-to-week fluctuations that don't really represent the overall course. This is, of course, terribly biasing in research because it can just tell you you're not doing the thing you wanted to do or you are doing something you didn't want to do. But in treatment, too, it can be confusing. And it's confusing because the doctor sees the patient one way, the patient, because of how they are at the point of presentation, may actually misremember recent events, so we tend to be very bad at reporting our own state even a week ago or 2 weeks ago. We're very much colored by current state. If you imagine last time you were in real pain when you stubbed your toe or something, it's hard to imagine not being in pain at that moment, right? It's all you have is the severity of the current symptom. So to me, as a practicing doctor still, and someone who still sees patients who have fluctuating illness, right? Mood disorders tend to fluctuate, psychotic disorders, addiction. All of these are fluctuating disorders that also have a chronic course. The ability to tease out the course of the fluctuation and to see where you are in an acute fluctuating process and then to map that onto the chronic course will make an enormous difference in everybody's ability to understand their patient's illness, for the patients to understand their own illness, and for us all to be speaking essentially what amounts to the same language driven by data in understanding what these illnesses look like to a patient, but also at some level what they really are. Much of our understanding of many of these illnesses is phenomenological. It's driven by observation. And as you pointed out in the question, our observations are limited by when we're there to make the observation or when the patient is recording his or her own observation. So the ability to observe better actually makes our ability to differentiate and phenotype these illnesses better. And the hope is that much more broadly than Parkinson's, while certainly in Parkinson's too, we'll start to be able to understand things about these illnesses that support drug development, certainly, but also support just the day-to-day management of these illnesses by patients, caregivers, and physicians.
Well, this is really an amazing project, and I congratulate Pfizer for stepping into this and undertaking it. I appreciate that information, and I certainly look forward to hearing more about this at Disruptive Innovations in September.
Ed, thank you. I have to say it is very exciting. We've got Pfizer, IBM in an 1860s house, and look what they're achieving. So congratulations to the Blue Sky team. Is there anything else you would like to highlight, Stephen, David, or Dan?
I think, to me, I do want to point out again that it's awfully important to understand the extent to which we are device agnostic, the extent to which we're interested in data standards and data exchange, the extent to which we are not a device company. We're not an endpoint company. We're a drug company. And while we're doing this work, certainly because it supports our ability to learn about compounds we're developing and how they work in patients we're interested in helping, we don't think and don't intend to go it alone. And our collaboration with IBM is indicative of that. But there's opportunity for collaboration more broadly in this space. And there's almost nobody working in a related field, whether they're academic, industry, independent, I guess, or really anyone who brings something to the table who we won't talk to or not interested in talking to and interacting with. And we found that we are fairly facilely able to have those conversations in a way that everybody feels comfortable being at the table.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all so much. I'd like to thank Ed for co-hosting and to our guests, Stephen, David, and Dan. And I'd like to give a shout-out to their colleague, Craig Lipset, who brought the blue sky topic to my attention. So thank you, Craig. Craig is one of the co-chairs at DPharm, where Dan and David will be presenting on September 20th. And Dan is also the chair of the Mobile and Clinical Trials Conference on September 19th. Both programs take place at the Fairmont Copley Hotel in Boston. And for more information about this radio program and conferences, please go to theconferenceforum.org. Thanks so much, everyone, again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Valerie and Ed, for having us.